Welcome to Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. I'm Kate Burdett. Coming up, YWCA Columbus is about to start its annual Bright Futures Leadership Program, and we'll learn more from the program's coordinator. Jay Fox has a conversation with the executive director of Disability Rights Ohio about an investigation into a case involving 17s from Franklin County. And we'll learn more about Ohio electric vehicle sales and a new charging station partnership when he talks to the director of energy at General Motors. Plus, Tracy Townsend of Face the State will have a look at state politics. First up on Columbus Perspective, for nearly 20 years, the Bright Futures Leadership Program at the YWCA Columbus has encouraged high school girls to look into social constructs of race and gender. And today we're joined by the program coordinator for the Bright Futures Program, Navya Nala. Hi, Navya. Thank you so much for being with us today on Columbus Perspective.
Hi, Kate. Thank you for having me. I'm excited to talk to you about Bright Futures.
Now, I understand there's a bit of a deadline coming up pretty soon for people to get involved. That is actually tomorrow. July 1st is the deadline to get registered for the upcoming leadership program, which is going to be a week-long cohort. Tell me a little bit about what young women who get involved in this will be experiencing.
Like, thank you for going over the overview of the program. So the program this year is actually going to be from July 15th through the 18th with the special graduation on the 19th, actually. And our focus in the Bright Futures program is to really empower the women we have in our program and allow them to see their own power that they have even as high schoolers. So the format of the program is going to be a week long. Each day they will be going through a two-hour session that involves different topics, all the way from race as a construct in this country, all the way through exploring gender norms and how that impacts their day-to-day lives. And even in going into community organizing, how they can become change agents in their community. So the program itself is a two-hour commitment Monday through Thursday, and we have a graduation on Friday. And this year, we're also really excited to do a art and activism portion of the program, where we'll have a local artist come out, and she'll be doing a art installation project with the participants as well around the idea of democracy and what democracy means in our community as well.
This program has to be extremely impactful. And as we as a community have noticed, there are some under-resourced neighborhoods in Central Ohio, specifically in Columbus, where young women and girls don't have access to programs like this. Because of that, are you and your colleagues at the YWCA specifically focusing on certain areas, or is this kind of just anyone in Columbus is involved?
Yes. So we are a community-based program. So we really like to focus on underserved communities, as you mentioned, the Hilltop or Linden areas, but we have opened the program open to everyone in Central Ohio, basically. Being a community-based program, we would like to, have any issues related to transportation and anything like that alleviated so that the girls can come to us or we can go to them typically. And that way, this program can be accessible to everyone. This summer, we are actually hosting it at our downtown location at the YWCA.
Now, what would qualify a girl to be involved in this? Are there any prerequisites or things that, you know, age limits or things like that to keep in mind?
Yes. So we just asked that this program is pretty selective in terms of wanting to have a smaller cohort. So we try to keep the cohort size no larger than 15. And we just asked that they're high school students 9 through 12 So the program is going to be focused around women-centered programming, but if you are non-binary or a gender-expansive youth who doesn't mind being a part of a women-centered program, we definitely encourage those individuals to apply. The biggest focus of the program is around, social activism and how to become an activist and a change agent in your community. So it really is a great program for those who want to be involved in the community. So if you want to learn how to be a leader and do those kinds of things, we definitely encourage those individuals to apply as well.
Navya Nala is the program coordinator for the Bright Futures Leadership Program at YWCA Columbus. They're about to get started with their cohort in mid-July, and their application deadline is actually July 1st, but they still are accepting applications. You can go online to ywcacolumbus.org to find out more and to even register for the cohort that's coming up, like I said, in a few weeks. Navya, do you have any, or your colleagues at the YWCA have any kind of stories or anecdotes about girls who have participated in this program in the past and what that has led to for them?
I'd say from a larger data perspective, of course, that we've had more than 90% of our participants walk away from the program saying that they feel more empowered to make change in their community and a better understanding of how race and systemic racism impacts their day-to-day life. From a more, individual perspective, we've had participants say that they've been able to feel more comfortable in their gender identity and even come out as being maybe non-binary because of the knowledge that they gained through the program. And I think one of the stories I always think about as well is that we've had a participant who really loved talking about the different topics that we cover in the program and felt really motivated to want to start like even a podcast around social justice issues. So really, I think having our program come into their schools and different spaces like that has given them expanded knowledge around issues that affect their day-to-day life. So they can kind of take those things into their own power and figure out how they can make long-term change.
It sounds like such an insurmountable task to talk about these issues of social justice and gender identity and so forth, especially with young women and girls who are in the throes of adolescence and so forth. But I can imagine, Navya, that you can speak to kind of the atmosphere around this cohort every year. And there has to be kind of a bit of an overwhelming sense of community and of empowerment and synergy between these girls as they put their heads together in this space to really talk through and consider these things.
Yes, there definitely is. And we are also really intentional about creating a safer space for the girls. So at least making sure we set community norms to make sure that they feel comfortable talking about these things. And we are really intentional about keeping the cohort small so that some of the more vulnerable topics that we cover and the stories that they share do kind of stay in our intimate community as well.
Now, tell me a little bit about the graduation, because that's a big part of this. After the week that is spent in this cohort, what is the graduation celebration and ceremony like?
Yes. So for our summer program, we're going to be hosting the graduation on the final day, that Friday. And it's going to be basically a ceremony that will hand out certificates to every girl who finishes the program. We also have a goodie bag that has different books and resources that they can use to continue alongside, along their journey of becoming a change agent in the community. And alongside that, of course, we'll do like food and dessert and things like that, just to really showcase the work that they did put into it. And in some instances, we have also allowed for this to become a service project opportunity for them as well. So that's been something that they have been able to like either fill out a form saying that they've committed or continue to do community service through this program, or they definitely can walk away with at least a certificate and a really lovely t-shirt that signifies that they were part of the Bright Futures community.
The Bright Futures Leadership Program, it's been going on at the YWCA Columbus for nearly 20 years and hopefully will continue for many more. This year's summer program starts in mid-July, and you have until July 1st or through July 1st to get online at ywcacolumbus.org to get registered. Navya Nala, Program Coordinator for Bright Futures, best of luck with this year's program, and thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you very much as well.
Columbus Perspective is a public affairs presentation of WBNS Radio. The opinions expressed on this program are those of its guests and do not necessarily reflect those of WBNS Radio, its staff, management, or sponsors.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's Jay Fox.
Disability Rights Ohio is the federally authorized protection and advocacy system for people with disabilities in Ohio. Kirsten Schoberg is their executive director, and we're talking with her today about an investigation, 16 months worth of an investigation, into a facility called Youth Intensive Services in Youngstown that found that things were not the way they should be. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me here today.
First of all, what prompted the investigation?
So we actually visited Youth Intensive Services in October of 2022 as part of a routine monitoring visit, as part of being the federally authorized protection advocacy system. We go to places like Youth Intensive Services and check in with the kids that are there and with the environment, see what's happening and if there's any concerns. So that's what prompted it. When we were there, we saw significant concerns, which led us to send a letter to the facility shortly after our monitoring visit. And when those were not addressed, we sent our concerns to the Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services, which licenses Youth Intensive Services in December of 2022 and opened up an investigation to find out more information and be able to advocate further on behalf of these children.
What you found, in short, was shocking. Had there not been reports from the individuals that were in treatment or their families alerting this possibility, or was it just something that was uncovered during routine investigative processes?
So it's a little bit of a mix, I would say. Many of these, pretty much all of these children are in children's services custody and have very little family advocacy involvement. So there isn't much of an advocate for them unless children's services is alerted to a concern. And there is a requirement that Youth Intensive Services report certain types of incidents to the Department of Mental Health. But in our investigation, we have found that they often do not report things that should have been reported. So much of what we uncovered, we were seeing before other people were seeing it, and we were passing it along to the Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services and to the children's services agencies that were sending their children there to let them know the problems that were happening at Youth Intensive Services, because we weren't sure that they were aware of them. The one entity that did at least have some information, and that's actually where we got it, was in 2024, we got the first 5 months worth of police reports from kids leaving the facility called going AWOL, and police would pick them up and bring them back. And those police reports showed that kids were reporting potentially sexual activity or sexual assault or drug use or things like that, or other injuries while they were away from the facility. So that's something that was technically reported elsewhere, but as far as we're aware, no criminal investigation or charges were pursued.
Yet, while they were in the care of Youth Intensive Services, it would stand to reason that it would be YIS's responsibility to know their whereabouts at all times. And truthfully, they should have been in the facility, correct?
That's right. One of our concerns is that YIS is not taking action to prevent AWOLs in an appropriate way by providing, you know, a therapeutic environment, a safe facility, interventions when it seems like a child might be considering fleeing. So we're concerned they're not taking sufficient action to prevent the AWOL. An occasional AWOL may still happen, right? Like, that does happen sometimes, but to have so many of them and to have such dangerous activity occurring while they're gone, and as far as we can tell, very little follow-up when the children return to the facility to address the trauma they may have experienced while away from it, or any additional work to prevent them from leaving in the future, is YIS's responsibility. And as far as we can tell, they are not addressing that.
So YIS is located in Youngstown, Ohio, which is in Northeast Ohio, yet patients come from all over the state, and some actually came from the Columbus area.
That's right. So children's services agencies will place from around the state have placed at YIS, and according to our records, in the last year, there have been at least seven placed there by Franklin County Children's Services. So kids that are from the Columbus area are potentially experiencing the abuse and the dangerous restraints, as well as the risk of harm by leaving the facility from YIS.
I want to drill down on one thing from the report specifically. Inappropriate, unapproved, and painful restraint techniques. Tell me a little bit more about that. How are these children painfully restrained?
Sure. So physical restraints are a behavior intervention that is supposed to be a very much last resort if it's necessary to intervene when there's a safety risk or concern that cannot be addressed through verbal or other sort of behavior interactions. And first of all, they're being used sort of without going through any of that de-escalation, that sort of verbal redirect, that ability to provide more of a therapeutic response. So that's part of it being inappropriate. But in addition to that, they're being often done in ways that harm kids. So for example, we have looked at hours and hours of video, and in that video, we've seen things like children being restrained up against objects such as chairs or trash cans with their heads sort of being placed at like an angle in a dangerous way. We've seen staff laying on top of children with their entire body weight. Sometimes we've seen at least one child that was on a prone restraint, which is not allowed to happen at all. And that's where you're face down with body weight. And we've even seen the other youth becoming involved in restraining other kids, which certainly is not supposed to be happening. So those are just some of the examples of what we're seeing in the videos. And, you know, this can obviously lead to multiple forms of harm. The trauma, of course, involved in having this occur, but also physical injury or even death. I mean, the reason prone restraints are banned in Ohio is because kids have died in other places when a prone restraint was used on them.
Well, and it also impacts the trust level that the patient has on the facility. Because if other members of, let's just call them their peers in the facility, are involved in the restraint, then how could they possibly feel safe in a facility that doesn't punish them for what might be construed violence?
Absolutely. And, you know, in our report, we tried to let the voices of the kids speak to some degree about what was happening to them, you know, about how, you know, one of the kids says, I used to be restrained all the time. Staff would never listen to me. I just wanted help, but they didn't understand that. That's an example. You know, sometimes when there are restraints, kids accidentally get hurt. It's very traumatic. That's another example of what a child has said about what they're experiencing. So you're right. There's a trust issue. And it also creates an environment where these kids start to think this is normal and they're not going to complain or advocate for themselves, right? Like this becomes their normal, and that's a dangerous environment as well.
So you conducted this 16-month investigation. You have uncovered your findings and they are now public knowledge. What happens next to YIS? Is there any kind of punishment or censuring, or is there litigation pending?
So that really depends on the licensing body, which is Mental Health and Addiction Services here in Ohio. We have asked them repeatedly to take action to fix the problems, to get YIS to take corrective action to fix the problems. And if that YIS can't, and certainly while they're trying to fix them, to take actions like suspending admissions so that additional children are not being put at risk while they're trying to get things, you know, taken care of. And if they can't, ultimately to revoke their license. Now, for those type of situations, there is usually an opportunity for a notice and a hearing by a YIS when you revoke or suspend a license. But if the Director of Mental Health and Addiction Services determines that the facility has demonstrated a pattern of serious noncompliance or that a violation creates a substantial risk to the health and safety of those kids, they can at least suspend admissions immediately. And that's the type of action we're asking them to take. So it really depends on the Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services, whether these kids are going to be safe, whether the YIS is going to be basically forced to change how they're operating if they want to stay open.
So if somebody from the Columbus area is referred to YIS and they don't want to go to YIS because they've heard of this, do they have other options?
You know, that's a great question. If it's a child and children's protection services, they may not really have a lot of choice in their system, right, in the way that those things work. However, if a child or a family member is aware that a kid is going to be sent there, I would strongly urge them to reach out to the Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services to raise the concern. Reach out, of course, to the Children's Services Placement Agency, and they can feel free to contact us as well. And we will do our best to advocate for that kid to get them not placed there. There are other residential facilities for children that are not causing this type of harm and trauma. That's not to say that they're all perfect. We have seen things like this sometimes at other places, but the severity, the constancy, and the lack of any sort of willingness to fix it is what makes YIS kind of stand out. Most other places, if we go in there and we see concerns and we raise them, the facility works hard to fix them, and even the Department of Mental Health has frequently stepped in to take action as well. So we're a little puzzled as to why that's not happening here, why the Department of Mental Health isn't taking aggressive action to make sure these kids are safe.
Well, I suppose we will find out as time goes on. Schertsen Schoberg, the Executive Director of Disability Rights Ohio, we thank you for joining us. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's more from Jay Fox.
Joining us on Columbus Perspective today is Derek Sequeira, who is the Director of Energy at General Motors. Welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So I have to ask before we begin, because that's quite a title, what does a Director of Energy do?
Hey, great question. I do get asked that a lot. What we're trying to do here at General Motors is really accelerate EV adoption. And the division that I work in, GM Energy, is tasked with building and pioneering solutions for every customer that will make that transition so much easier. It starts with educational and engagement tools that will help customers and dealers really embrace what an electric vehicle means to them in terms of lifestyle, sales, and then expanding that to building out an amazing product and solutions ecosystem that helps take away those anxieties that a customer may have when transitioning to an electric vehicle, like cost, range, charge, ownership. That's what we do here at GM Energy, and I'm very proud to be part of this that group that's accelerating EV adoption here at General Motors.
So according to the U.S. Department of Energy, there are over 34,000 electric vehicles registered here in the state of Ohio as of July of last year, and that puts the Buckeye State kind of in the middle of the pack, despite a new EV manufacturing plant in operation in the state. So why do you think the Buckeye State is in the middle of the pack and not toward the top?
Yeah, hey, that is a very interesting statistic there. Ohio is really doing some great stuff when it comes to educating on electric vehicles and investing in electric vehicles as well. Part of our mandate is to make charging accessible for customers. And we're doing it through the home, but we're also doing it through public charging. And our projects with EVgo and Pilot Flying J are going to help build out a charging network that will make charging easy and accessible for customers. And we've got some really great examples of our collaboration with Pilot Flying J right in Ohio that we know are getting used and customers are starting to rave about, given the accessibility and amenities that we have at those locations. So that's just another example of GM working to make electric vehicle charging more accessible right here in the state of Ohio.
So is charging the issue that made electric vehicles not as popular? I mean, you can track it back to the 1800s, and then you guys had a vehicle in the 90s, I remember, called the EV1. Was the charging the issue for the failure of this product prior to today?
Charging has always been on customers' minds, but I think what the big difference is today is that charging is something that we deal with every day. You know, if you think of your phone, that is a electronic device that you take and utilize during the day. And when you get home, you plug it in, you wake up, and it's ready to go. That's the big difference today when it comes to electric vehicles. With great home charging options and products out there, you can have the electric vehicle charged and ready to go for the average American commute of 40 miles by installing a great level 2 charger in your home, such as our GM power-up charger. That's the type of confidence that customers are now getting as they're starting to realize that, okay, now an electric vehicle, it is like my phone.
So is it like your phone in the case of, for example, an iPhone charger is different from an Android charger? So if I have an EV, do I have to have a charger specific to the manufacturer, or will your charger be kind of a one-size-fits-all?
Hey, great question. There are multiple charging standards out there, and that has been a little bit fragmented in the past, right? There's been the CHAdeMO standard, the CCS standard, and the North American charging standard, now called J3400. What we're moving towards is a unified standard and moving over to the North American charging standard, or the J3400. And that will help make sure that all vehicles within the GM umbrella will have that great experience and accessibility to more chargers that are out there. Now, of course, it's gonna take some time. We are gonna start converting our portfolio over slowly. But there will be a period where, you know, we'll have to get used to utilizing adapters. But overall, I think it'll be a great fit for the entire industry as more and more manufacturers look towards this common standard.
So if there is a common standard, then manufacturers who don't adhere to it now, there could be an adapter that would make it usable, because there are obviously many other manufacturers besides General Motors that make EVs today.
Yeah, I think a lot of manufacturers are moving towards a common standard, but during that transition period, there will be adapters out there to make sure that you've got compatibility and reach to all of your customers.
So what happens if I don't have a garage and I have to park outside? Does that mean that I have to rely on Pilot and Flying J to charge, or is there another option?
Great question. There are several options. And let me tell you, there are over 170,000 options available to GM customers, whether you're in a Chevrolet Blazer or a Cadillac Lyriq, all within the navigation system of the car, or Google built-in, or utilized through the My Chevrolet or My Cadillac apps. So you have access to navigate to those 170,000 plus chargers across the United States and Canada that are more than just the chargers that we are working on building out. So taking all of these chargers, you've got several options to really make sure that you know you've got a charging option if home charging is not possible for you.
Now, we did a story this week about the rising cost of energy in the summer months. What is the impact that owning an EV has on the electric bill? Because I would imagine that that would be something that you would want to know about before you make that commitment.
Yeah, I think that is something that comes up often. And yeah, I'll give you a little bit of a personal anecdote here. I was having a chat with a colleague a couple weeks ago, and they were telling me about how much it costs to fill up their gas fuel truck. And it was something like, oh, a little over $100. And I chuckled. It cost me about the same amount to fuel my EV utilizing home charging over the entire month. And there are great programs out there with some utilities that actually reward you for having an EV and signing up for their time of use rates, where you can get lower rates if you charge during their periods where they want you to charge. Or even in some jurisdictions, they will allow you to charge at lower rates when you're running, when the grid's running on green energy. So that's the present. In the future, we're going to be working on managed charging programs where the utility can actually help send signals to your vehicle to charge when they've got the best rates out there. So this is just the beginning of working with utilities and looking at ways to optimize the way energy is consumed across the country. And like I said, that's just the beginning. There's also a new frontier where, yes, you're focused right now on putting energy into the vehicle, but when the vehicle is sitting on your driveway, it can actually be part of the solution to help with some of those energy and grid costs.
Derek Sequeira is the director of energy at General Motors. New data suggests that the electric vehicle market is about to have another growth spurt. So a lot of folks will be considering the opportunity to switch to an electric vehicle as a possibility. And we want to thank you for answering some of our questions about EVs and their maintenance. For Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Now, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10 TV, here's Tracy Townsend from the Sunday morning public affairs program Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10 TV.
Ohioans will head to the polls in about 5 months to decide not only who will be the next president, but also a host of other issues. Already, tens of millions of dollars are being spent in Franklin County to ensure the election runs smoothly. 10TV's Kevin Landers begins our coverage with a look into how election workers are preparing right now for the November 5th election.
Leading Biden by a lot.
Former President Donald Trump.
They found Donald Trump guilty on all 34 felony counts.
And President Joe Biden are not the only ones headlining the November election. Ohioans will also cast their ballots to decide who will represent them in the U.S. Senate, as Democrat Sherrod Brown and Republican challenger Bernie Moreno also battle for votes.
There are three Supreme Court races that are high of mind. And people are talking about. Then we have all our local elections. So there's a lot that will be voted on here.
That's not all. Ohioans could also vote on a proposal to raise the state's minimum wage. Supporters are hoping they can get enough verified signatures by July to make the November ballot. To ensure those votes are counted correctly, Franklin County has allocated millions of dollars to make sure election officials have the right people in place. The county says it will need 5,200 poll workers on election day. They will continue to be the highest paid poll workers in the state, earning a base of $133 on election day. New this year, four seasonal workers at the Board of Elections will now be paid full-time salaries to handle more voters.
We're going to see an increased amount of voter registrations come in. We're going to see an increased amount of absentee applications come in. We're going to see an increased amount of voters coming to our early vote center to vote. And so we need more people to assist in handling those processes.
117,000 Franklin County voters voted early in the 2020 presidential election. Franklin County is expected to hit that number or exceed it this year. And this will be the first presidential election where voters will need a photo ID to cast their ballot since the law passed in April of last year.
Elections officials say one of the challenges they face every year is finding enough poll workers. The director of the Franklin County Board of Elections says it's Republican poll workers that are often the hardest to find. The law says no more than 50% can be of one party when it comes to being able to work at polling stations. Now, as we look toward the election, we talk with the League of Women Voters of Ohio's Executive Director Jen Miller. She tells us the most important thing for voters to do when they cast their ballot is to vote for everything, not just president.
Our message to voters is that they need to vote on everything on their ballot. They should vote their entire ballot. We know that presidential years tend to have higher turnout, which is great, but we want to make sure that when Ohio voters show up, that they don't skip any of the races. Those statewide issues, those local issues and levies, all the way down to a local judge. What we know is that a lot of voters skip those local races, and those are really critical.
Meantime, one issue you could see lower on the ballot is a new COTA levy. If it passes, the levy would raise sales tax by half a penny. COTA leaders say that increase would generate $6.5 billion over the next 30 years. It would help build hundreds of miles of sidewalks, bikeways, and pathways within COTA's service area. Franklin County Commissioner Erica Crawley says focusing on transit is important for our community.
But I can't talk about housing if I'm not talking about transportation. I can't talk about healthcare if I'm not talking about transportation. I can't talk about education and, again, getting to jobs and businesses if we're not talking about transportation. Transportation is embedded in everything that we are doing in order to make sure that all of our residents here in Franklin County can thrive and not just survive.
The levy would also fund 5 new rapid transit corridors and increase COTA service by 45%. COTA leaders say ultimately it would help alleviate traffic in the city. Columbus Mayor Andrew Ginther says this investment is necessary as the community grows.
This is a community that is on the move. It is on the rise. I always say the sun is always rising in Columbus, but it's time for us to prepare for the morn and make sure that as this dawn of a new era for this community takes shape, that we're planning for the future and that we're planning to create the jobs, the opportunity, the education.
Voters in all of COTA's service territory will be able to vote on this issue in November. More than 158,000 people are now on Ohio's voter purge list. This means before the November election, they're going to be removed as registered voters because county boards of elections flag them as inactive voters. That is unless they take action now. Voters who filled out a national change of address form indicating that they have permanently moved are the most commonly affected. Broken down by county, Franklin County has the most on the list, with more than 23,000 voter registrations at risk of being removed from the system. Delaware and Fairfield counties have about 2,000 each. And Madison County only had 76 names on its list. Now, if you are on the list, you still have more than a month to update your registration and avoid removal from the state's registration. All you have to do is update your address online, through the mail or in person, or engage in voter activity like submitting an absentee ballot application. If you miss that deadline and you're purged from the voter rolls, you do have to register to vote again with your correct address. The deadline to register is October 7th, with early voting starting the very next day. A former executive at First Energy could call Governor Mike DeWine and Lieutenant Governor John Husted as witnesses in his trial. This is according to court documents from Summit County. Michael Dowling is facing charges related to the $60 million bribery scheme. Earlier this week, Governor DeWine deflected questions about his relationship with former First Energy executives. This comes after text messages revealed he asked for money ahead of his first campaign for governor in 2018. DeWine also seemed frustrated with questions after reporters asked him about the $500,000 the now indicted CEO put into a PAC for him. Governor Mike DeWine deflecting those questions about his relationship with former First Energy execs.
Let me just say, I followed the law, and you can look the law up just as well as I can. But I, you know, you're not going to see me violate the law. We're going to follow the law about coordination.
Already this year, First Energy CEO Chuck Jones and Senior VP Michael Dowling were charged with bribery. Plus, former House Speaker Larry Householder is now serving a 20-year prison sentence. Several major bills are still making their way through the legislative process, and that includes one piece of legislation that would change the rules around seatbelt and booster seat violations in our state. Right now, law enforcement has to stop you for something else, like speeding, before they can then address the other violations. However, lawmakers are hearing House Bill 536 would make it a primary offense rather than a secondary one. And that means officers and troopers no longer need any other reason. This is all something Governor Mike DeWine called for in his State of the State address earlier this year. To make his case, DeWine cited stats from an Ohio Department of Public Safety survey that showed seatbelt use in Ohio hit its lowest level in nearly two decades.
Ohio is 10th from the bottom, 10th from the bottom of all states in seatbelt use. While the national average for seatbelt use is 91%, Ohio's number is only 81%.
Violations
House Bill 536 is still in a House committee and has a long way to go before it could reach the governor's desk to become law. Right now, there is a push at the Ohio State House to make sure college kids are getting the mental health support they need. House Bill 572 would require the Chancellor of Higher Education to conduct an audit of programs to determine what type of instruction they're providing students. The focus would be on mental and behavioral health and management, along with some recommendations. This is still in the committee stage in the House. Young student athletes could soon be required by the state to get a physical exam before they even take the field. That's the goal of House Bill 256, which is in committee. The Healthy Cardiac Monitoring Act prohibits students and young athletes from participating in athletic activities unless they get a physical. The same bill also requires the state to develop guidelines and educational materials related to sudden cardiac arrest in children and adults.
Again, that's Tracy Townsend, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10 TV. From the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10 TV. This has been Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. Heard each Sunday morning at 6 on WBNS FM 97.1 The Fan and on 1460 AM ESPN Columbus.